You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So I know that some of you are here because you know who the secret guest is, but many of you are here because you know we just always have amazing guests. And the most amazing thing about tonight's guest is that he is the 2026 Celebrity Mastermind Champion. We'll find out about his special interest very shortly, but also perhaps more importantly, he is a journalist and award-winning filmmaker. Hope and I can give it up for Mubeen Azhar.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
I know you wanted a cake to jump out of.
I asked for a cake to jump out of. No one bought a cake for me to jump out of, so.
Are you a Singing in the Rain fan?
I love Singing in the Rain.
We could have, there's a musical sequence, you know the one I'm referring to.
Yes, with a cake.
Yeah. That's what I'm picturing.
We could have done that, but no. Maybe next year. If we plan it differently.
I know the dance for that sequence, so I can do the dance and you can jump out the cake.
Perfect. It's sorted. Got a plan. Let's do it.
Welcome to Greenbelt, Mubeen.
Thank you so much. It's my first Greenbelt. It's very nice. Yeah.
You've been here all afternoon.
I have.
You've been interviewed by Elizabeth Oldfield.
Yes.
Feeling a little bit like a poor man's Elizabeth Oldfield because she's brilliant.
She's really good.
It's a lot of pressure. But we're going to have a different conversation tonight. We're going to have a chat. We're going to play Conversations Against Mundanity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's going to be a spinning wheel. It's going to be very camp. And then we'll take some audience questions. How does that sound?
That sounds delicious. That sounds very nice.
Not as delicious as jumping out of a cake.
No, almost.
I just looked at my notes. I just said, Mubeen, before I go on, I'm just going to, here it is. I'm going to read my notes page that I've been taking as I've been watching some of your documentaries. And my first note was, skin is amazing.
That is all down to my husband, who has a file on his computer, which is skincare. And he rotates skincare routines for me. So he's there. Take a bow. Yeah.
Tim, everybody. Excellent work.
Thank you so much.
Do you want to just maybe... just help us out. A couple of tips.
Yeah, so what is it called? Retinol? Retinol is very good for you. Drink lots of water. Vitamin C cream in the morning. And that's it. That's it.
Vitamin Simple. C. I saw a clip recently of Hannah Fry saying vitamin C and retinol.
Yeah.
And I noticed that every millennial woman I've spoken to since has been like,
vitamin C and retinol. And also, the other thing which isn't necessarily a skin thing, but I just really like is ginger shots. Recently, as a present... got a juicer that does ginger shots specifically. Very delicious, very good for you. Yes.
You can take the boy out of Huddersfield and put him in East London and all of a sudden...
it's just ginger shots and matcha lattes in East London. That's all it is. Yeah.
It sounds lovely. My other note, I have the first three notes are so shallow. The second one was, what's Vogue Williams like?
And oh my God, yeah.
Nobody here will know who Vogue Williams is.
Do you not know Vogue Williams? Come on, you know the Fairy Liquid adverts?
Sorry, I'm offended.
Not Fairy Liquid, it's Fairy Capsules. Fairy Capsules. So she's a lovely woman, Irish accent. She's a model, former model. And I did a series with her. It's a good series. It's not necessarily like the most representative of my work.
Don't start there, but do watch it.
It was a 6-part series for BBC One. It was called Plastic Surgery Undressed. Me and Vogue Williams in a studio. And we got people that were considering cosmetic procedures to watch the surgery, like the surgery happened in front of them. And then they decided whether they wanted to continue or didn't want to, which was very good. I personally, I've got no issue with, if you want to have cosmetic surgery, go for it. But I was very happy because, for example, there was this one adorable, like 18 or 19 year old, and she didn't like her nose. I thought she had the most lovely nose. And then she watched rhinoplasty happening. And then at the end of it, it's like, I just don't want it done. I'm going to learn to love my nose. And I thought I did my job well. So I was really happy. So she loved her nose. And she kept in touch with me and she never had the surgery. So I was very happy. But if you want a rhinoplasty, go for it.
But what? Maybe watch your program first.
Maybe watch the program first. Be informed. That's the thing. Yeah.
And is Vogue Williams a total babe?
Vogue Williams is absolutely adorable. She's married to, you know who Spencer Matthews is?
From Made in Chelsea.
He's actually very nice as well. I have to say... he's not here, is he? Bit self-obsessed, right?
He might
because, I mean, come on, you go in there, I'm just going to tell you, You go in their bathroom. You know, in the bathroom, do you know what all the pictures on the wall are? They're all him. Like, every single picture is of him. And he actually, the first time I went to their house, he's like, I'll just show you around. So, like, okay, that's nice. But by showing me around, what he actually meant is he'll take me to the bathroom and say, that's when I was on the cover of Esquire magazine. That's page 7 of Men's Health. Have you seen my abs there? That's all he was just talking through his greatest hits. It was ridiculous. So, but he's lovely. They're a lovely couple. Yeah.
Tell us about your bathroom. What's on the walls?
My bathroom, oh, it's really nice. I live in East London in a lovely little two-bedroom flat. Our bathroom is charcoal grey, kind of metallic, with black tiles. It's quite minimalist, and we got it done 10 years ago. It's still delicious and lovely. It's very nice. Yeah.
No awards in the bathroom?
No awards in the bathroom. The awards are kept. Can I just say something? So on the way in, when we were saying hi to each other, Lucy was very lovely and saying, is there anything you'd like me to specifically mention or specifically don't mention? And I said,
please mention the awards.
No, I didn't. No,
within
I did
the first
not.
5 minutes.
That wasn't even the joke. The joke was, I said, you can talk about anything you want. And then Tim, my husband, chipped in and said, just make sure he gets very shy if you talk about his awards. So just don't talk about those. And then they both laughed at me. So if you want to talk about the awards, fine.
I would like to know where they are.
The awards are, so all of them are in the middle room. Should I go through the awards? So
yeah, tell us about your awards.
Okay. So the awards are in the middle room, apart from one which is kept in the front room. The one that is kept in the front room is a BAFTA. That's the one that I keep on display. All the other ones are on a shelf in the middle room. The BAFTA that you have to see if you come to the house.
Oh, man, yeah. So we have a mutual friend. I've got a friend from uni, chose very well with my friends, and she worked for BAFTA for a bit, and she took me to the BAFTAs. So it wouldn't have been the same as you, she took me to the film BAFTAs.
Yes.
And it was 2020. It was just before lockdown.
Okay.
So lockdown came and I was like, fine, I've
done it. Did you have a good time?
I literally bumped into Andrew Scott.
Ah! Oh my word,
and
okay.
It was the best day of my life.
So good. Was the food's really good, isn't it?
Yeah, and the champagne. And the thing I would say is, I started out with saying, a little Gateshead girl, I don't belong here. And by the end, I was like, these are my people.
Yeah, exactly.
I really felt like I belonged.
Did you get a goodie bag?
I did not.
So the year I went, got a goodie bag, and it had a beard trimmer in it, which I thought was like quite specific.
Is that
it?
just for
just
you?
Just for me. Beard trimmer had a hair dryer in it. I think it was sponsored by L'Oreal or something ridiculous like that. But people, honestly, at the end, people were taking 2 goodie bags each because they were like, I want another hair dryer. It was completely ridiculous.
Wow. No, I was very much a player, but apart from my Andrew Scott moment. When you're in rooms like that with the Andrew Scotts of the world, are you like, yeah, I belong here. This award is very natural.
I'd say no. To be completely honest, I'm from Huddersfield. Very like lovely, hardworking parents. Dad is a bus driver. Both retired now. I think I didn't really come from you know people in TV. Is there anyone from TV here? No. People in TV, what you need to know. There's a lot of nepotism. Everyone is like, you'll bump into, I don't know, Tarquin. And Tarquin, you'll say, oh, yeah, how long have you been in the industry? And Tarquin will say, well, like, my dad was the editor of Dispatches. And so I just did work experience and now I'm here. And like, good for Tarquin, brilliant. But there's a lot of nepotism. And so I didn't really come from that background.
And how did you do it? How did you go from Huddersfield? Dad is a bus driver. Stay at school, right?
Yeah.
How did you get to BAFTA in the living room, hanging out with Tarquin?
So so I started off in like local papers, like tiny, tiny little local paper when I was a student at Leeds Uni. And then I think, to be completely honest, I think I had, maybe I share this with people in the room, I think I had like quite idealistic and grandiose ideas of my place in the world. And what I mean by that is not in an arrogant way. What I mean is I always thought I want to change the world and I want to like fight for justice. And I don't apologize for that. I think like, you know, when people talk about young people being idealistic, I think it's great to be idealistic. I think like, everyone should want to change the world. I think everyone should be. I was talking to someone earlier about the concept of social justice warriors being used as some kind of insult. What is that? The greatest thing you can be as a social justice warrior, right? Like, what else would you want to be? a social injustice warrior. Like, what are you talking about? Or like, people talk about being woke. What, do you want to be asleep? Are you stupid? Like, what are you talking about? So it, I think it's great to be quote unquote woke and be a social justice warrior. And I think I was very much in that place when I was a young person all those decades ago. And I think that's why I wanted to do the job that I do. And I, yeah. Whether I achieved that or not is a whole different subject. But that was definitely like my motivating force.
Well, I still see that, I think, in some of your documentaries. I noticed you use this phrase, I'm going to get it wrong, about, and you use language about social justice, about holding people to account. And when you say it, there's a, you can see like the fire in your belly, like where you're like, if this person has power and influence, there's obviously like a journalistic principle that you, oh, I'm going to sound like Elizabeth Oldfield,
do
that
it,
you,
do
you
it.
Hold sacred.
Yeah, that's, and she's here, she's in the room. Elizabeth
channeling
Oldfield,
it.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So I think we're kind of in a weird time, aren't we? In the sense that we talk about kind of accountability, but I think a lot of the people, or a lot of the groups of people that are targeted in the press and the media, which I'm part of, at the moment, in recent times, there's a lot of punching down. So we, like, how many conversations are there all the time about, scary people in boats that are coming over. Oh my God, isn't it like, you know, moral panic, or like trans people. Oh my God, they're going to come into your bathroom and like, who knows what's going to happen. I think a lot of that is nonsense. And I think it's like, it's really easy because you got to understand, like, a lot of that moral panic, I think, is coming from people with power. So it's coming from the Daily Mail. It's coming from the Telegraph. It's often coming from oligarchs that don't even live in our country, you know, like Elon Musk. And so I don't think that stuff is healthy. I don't think that stuff is healthy at all. And so when I think, when I'm talking about holding people to account, I'm talking about generally people with power. I think, you know, like we can talk, I know this is like broadly a Christian festival, and we can talk about faith and groups of people with particular faiths. I think generally the dividing factor in all societies around the world at the moment is people with power and people without power. I think that's actually the defining thing. And I think when I talk about holding people to account, what I aspire to do is be on the side of people without the power. That's what I'd like to do.
Yeah, I think I see that in your documentaries, and it strikes me that it's really important that you came from Huddersfield. Do you know, you weren't a Tarquin. And so
I got nothing. I feel really bad for Tarquin now. It's like, I've got nothing against Tarquin. He's all right.
Yeah, okay.
If there's any Tarquins in the room, I'm very sorry.
Well, I'll stop talking about Tarquin. But I am interested in the fact that you had that fire in your belly, were a woke social justice warrior. You were like, I'm going to make the world a better place. And you went into local papers. You climbed your way up. We know that local journalism is just in ruins. And actually, like, journalism itself is a threat. And the people who you're describing who have power control so much of that, increasingly so. Would it be as easy now in 2026 for a wee lad from Huddersfield to get to where you are, do you think?
Do you know what? I would love to be able to say, and I get lots of emails from people, and I mentor, we were talking about this earlier, with the Royal Television Society. So I'd love to be able to say, it's a meritocracy and just work really hard and have ideas, because your ideas are your currency. Some of that is true, but I think you're right to identify that increasingly we live in a time where it's often about connections. It's about who you know. It's about the background you come from. So much nepotism. And I think that is really scary. And I don't think it's a sign of a healthy society. I don't think it's a good thing. And I think we need to fight against it. That's what I believe.
How do you like keep your hands clean in your documentary making? Like, you see so many documentaries now about people that are like funded by them. They're executive producers.
Oh, right.
Like, how do you make sure that you're feeling free to actually ask the questions that need asking?
So I think generally like maybe 90% of every doc I've ever made, I've done some Channel 4 stuff, but 90% of everything that I've ever done has been on the BBC. And I am not here for one second to say the BBC is amazing and perfect, because it's not, and it gets certain things wrong, and it gets things wrong too often. But broadly, what is the BBC about? It's about public service broadcasting. And if you understand the principle of public service broadcasting, it's the idea that it's owned by everyone and it aspires to and should serve everyone. the rules that the BBC plays by and public service broadcasting plays by are different to the rules of the Wild West. And when I talk about the Wild West, I'm talking about Instagram influencers. I'm talking about YouTube. I'm even talking about this. I've got friends like that work in commissioning at Amazon. Does anyone watch Clarkson's Farm? So Clarkson's Farm, you might think the program's lovely, and I can see it's got entertainment value. You've got to remember, Jeremy Clarkson was at the center of like a massive row where he punched one of his production team members, right? It's a bit awkward, right? And then he left the BBC. And what did Amazon do? They were like, you know what? We'll pay you even more money.
We'll sweep you up.
You want to punch people? Don't worry about it. He wrote an article, didn't he, about Meghan Markle saying that she should be publicly like flogged. Like, I don't think he's the nicest person. I wouldn't personally like want to work with him. Do you know what I mean? And so I don't think that would happen at the BBC. They wouldn't take someone like that back. Do you know what I mean? And so I think I've got a bit of a safety net in that the vast majority of my work, all my work has been for public service broadcasters. So that's how I think I've managed to keep my hands clean.
But if you were going to get your hands dirty, pay your TV license, everyone. I'm
going to come around and check in a little bit, okay? So
I know someone who worked in a prison and they claim that someone was in there because they hadn't paid their TV license. And
what?
I don't know if it's true, but if it's a clever rumour, then it really works because every year I'm like, paying my TV license.
That's not true. Can I tell you?
It's not true.
Can I tell you a prison story, though?
Yes, so I've watched your prison documentary. Very good.
So I made a series about corruption in prisons, went out a few months ago, and I met this one prison guard who shall remain unnamed. So she did a non-ID interview, took ages to persuade her to do it, and then she did it, and we had to disguise her voice and everything, and we turned up. So I met her, and then she was like, what disguise shall I use? She had like three different masks and all this stuff, so she used the disguise. Anyway, the story goes, and this is true because I met the person she ended up with. So she was a prison guard who fell in love with a prisoner. They started a whole empire. So they started off like just bringing like weed into the prison. Within a year, they were supplying all contraband, including phones and drugs, to the whole prison. They had a business empire. She continued working as a prison guard. He served the rest of his sentence. They fell in love. They came out. The house they live in today, she never got caught, by the way. The house they live in today was paid for by the money that she made in prison by smuggling in contraband. And they've got two kids. The whole empire, the whole family is paid for. The car outside the house, it was a really nice car, was paid for by the money that she made. And guess what? She still goes to work as a prison guard.
So you didn't make that clear in the documentary. I don't think that she's still a prison guard.
We did a reference that she still works as a prison guard.
Oh my goodness.
She still works as a prison guard.
So the whole, it's really good. I watched the two parts last weekend with my friend who's about to be induced. So it's the last thing she watched on TV before she had a baby.
Oh,
and she
wow.
was like, I don't know if I want to bring a baby into the
world. Oh no,
So it all revolves around this clip that went around on TikTok, which makes me feel very naive because my algorithms are not feeding me this stuff. But it's this clip of a prison guard having sex with a couple of prisoners.
Yeah.
You showed quite a lot of that clip, didn't you? I was scandalized, Mabeen.
So the starting point of that whole thing was, I don't know if anyone remembers it. It was everywhere in the summer of, we're on 26, aren't we? So the summer of 24, autumn of 2024. There's this clip that did the rounds. It was picked up by a lot of the tabloids. And as you say, it was a woman, a prison guard, in her uniform having sex with two prisoners. And it had made its way out of the prison. And so there was all these questions about, was she coerced? Why have people got smartphones in the prison? What, they were doing drugs whilst the whole thing was happening. And why are they having sex? And then there was a whole, the whole thing went to court. She was charged with bringing an office of, officer. She was an officer in the public eye and bringing her office into disrepute. It's a very specific charge. And so I followed that trial, but then that was the kind of way in to look at corruption more broadly. And then we looked at contraband, we looked at drugs, we looked at drones flying into prisons, we looked at the whole prison economy, we looked at prison, like people really high up in that whole chain. So it was quite grim, I'd say.
It wasn't hopeful watching. I was was I glad to know? It felt important to know. What I really want to ask you is all the questions about that woman in a disguise and the house and stuff, but I'm not going to go there. I'm going to stay on the important stuff. You took like a year to get all that footage, didn't you? Yeah. I'll make this question longer and you can have a drink.
Yeah, please. So thank you.
I'll tell you a little bit more. It's two parts. It's incredibly damning about our prison system, isn't it? It is just obviously such a broken system, men's prisons specifically. Mubeen is so gracious. And the first question you're asking is, you don't do the tabloid thing, do you, about like this, what's this woman doing? You say, what is going on here? There is power, mostly from the people who are in the cells. Is she being coerced? But it struck me that the length of time that you shot that for, and it shows you sort of chasing loads and loads of leads that don't quite come to anything. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of people doing PhDs where it's like you committed to something for so long and obviously you like put a lot of blood, sweat and tears mm-hmm. into it. It must take a lot from you to spend so much time on something that's so dark. What? Tell us about the process of doing it over such a long period of time.
Yeah, so I have to say, I always work with like really lovely people. I've got a really skilled team and stuff, and like work with really great people. And so it's a big team effort. It's never about one person. But a lot of that job is like persuading people to talk that don't want to talk. So that included, for example, other people that had ended up being charged and found guilty because they'd had sex with prisoners. It involved that whole economy, the contraband economy, sometimes about drug dealers, people that have made lots of money, all that kind of stuff. But again, I think, you know, that the principle I was talking about, but you've got to look at that stuff in terms of people in power. So I think the way the tabloids did it was, hey, here's a crazy salacious story about a woman that had sex in prison. Isn't she terrible? I don't think that's doing the story justice, because ultimately, if you look at, I don't know if anyone knows anything about prison guards, a lot of the time get these days, they get 12 weeks training and then they're just put on a ward. Not a ward, what's it called? It is a, yeah. They're like, go, that's your wing. Yeah. So just take care of that wing. And they're dealing with the most horrific stuff. And they're spending time every day with, you know, sometimes class A prisoners that are convicted of some of the most horrible crimes you can think of. And so you've got to think about who has power in that context. And a lot of that stuff, I'm quite a political person, so I'm just going to say it. The prison system is the way it is because we've seen kind of government after government and year after year, we've seen the asset stripping of many public institutions, which includes the prison system. So you've got a system whereby every year you've got government thinking, how can we cut a corner here? And how can we save money here? And how can we, you know, defund this and defund this and defund this, and that's gonna have manifest results. And that's what actually, you know, when I met all the prison guards and people that are in those unions who said that for a long time, you know, they took so much pride in their work, and it was about prison being a process of rehabilitation, not just punishment. That's a completely different mindset, where now you've got people being locked up sometimes, like, I'm talking about 23 hours a day in their cells. How is that rehabilitating anyone? And it doesn't, this is the thing, the Daily Mail will not like this because they're like, prisoners committed a crime, criminals, bad people, end of. The world doesn't work like that. Like, you might think they're bad people, they don't need rehabilitation. That doesn't mean that we should lack compassion. Of course, if you've ended up in prison, it's probably because, you know, there's been a route there. You might have had a really difficult life. You might have been, you know, experienced really difficult circumstances. The Telegraph and the Daily Mail don't want to have that conversation. As a society, I think we should have that conversation.
And this is why journalism is so important, because that's an example of journalism driving public opinion that's driving policy, which means that things are just getting worse and worse and worse. And all of a sudden you get these people in prisons who hold and exert power over, like, well, you're kind of exposing prison governors like that high. And we need good journalism that says that we need a new system.
I really appreciate that. I mean, I think I'm always happy when programs, for example, get discussed in Parliament. The prison one did, it got discussed in Parliament, which I was really, really happy about. And then there'll be a discussion on the Today program and they'll like play some clips and stuff. So I get really happy when that stuff happens, but I'm not naive in the sense that I know it doesn't change like that. I wish it did. I really wish it did. I think that kind of 19-year-old in me, when I started like having these aspirations, or the 18-year-old in me thought like, yeah, I'll do a doc and it's everything's going to change. It's going to be great. And I kind of, there's a part of me that really holds on to that stuff. But I think the older I get, I don't know, do people, does everyone just get more jaded? Maybe I'm getting more jaded. I get a bit less optimistic about stuff.
There was a talk at Greenbelt a couple of years ago about what you described at the beginning about being young and full of fire and being like, I can change the world. It's going to be me. I'm going to be the one. And then actually most people go through a trajectory and become a bit more jaded.
Yeah.
And then you get maybe older and wiser and you see the things that are really important. And they said, we mustn't see that becoming jaded as a really bad thing. And we mustn't look down on like, say Gen Z and say, no, you're not going to be the ones to change the world, because there's a place for every generation. And actually, if we could do better working together across the generations, all those voices could be in the room for change.
I think that's true. And Lucy, can I just say, you know, we talk about younger people and everyone is like a bit cynical. And like I think every generation, it's their rite of passage when we get to our 40s or whatever.
Being is older than he looks. It's so all I'm, the retinol.
I'm 46. It's the retinol, right? So I think when you're 40-something, it's like a rite of passage thing. Oh my God, what are these young people doing? I actually think a lot of Gen Z kind of morality is brilliant. I think Gen Z like has boundaries. We never had any boundaries. Gen Z is like talking about their mental health. Like, we didn't do that.
God forbid. Like, boundaries and talking about your mental health.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so good. Gen Z is idealistic. Gen Z is saying, you know, why hasn't Beyonce made a statement about Palestine? Good. Why hasn't Beyonce made a statement about Palestine? Good for Gen Z bringing that up. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I think it's brilliant. So I have faith in Gen Z, and I think Gen Z ultimately, you know, they're the people, and the people that, what's the Stevie Wonder song? I believe the children are our future.
That's not Stevie Wonder. Who's that? Whitney Houston.
Whitney
Houston.
No, is it Whitney? I
believe. Teach them well and maybe, let them
yeah,
lead
what,
the
whoever
way.
It is, that song is appropriate for this moment. So what I'm saying is I believe in the ability of young people to kind of take us out of this.
Oh, yeah. You sound
Did
like
you enjoy
an
my
elder.
Singing? Yeah.
How much time have we got? She says, knocking a water bottle over. It's 7 o'clock. We're halfway through. I really want to ask you about techno, and I really want to ask you about your celebrity mastermind special topic.
Yes.
And I also really want to ask you about growing up in Huddersfield and now ending up in East London. We just briefly mentioned the gay scene in East London, and like, I want to know about what that's like now and what journey you had to go on personally. And I also want to take questions from the audience, and I want to play Cards Against Mundanity. So where do you want to go next? Your choice.
So maybe, is anyone from East London here? This isn't very East London. Oh, you are? Oh, my God. Okay, you don't have an ironic mustache, so that's why I couldn't identify you. So I love East London so much. I've lived there for 14 years, 15 years now, so it's very much home. I really love it. I'd say, are there queer people here? Yes. Yeah. Okay. So if you put those two things together, East London and queer people, there's such a particular alchemy at the moment, because I would say, there was a time where, you know, like people were just like, they're just identified as like gay or lesbian or trans, whatever it might be. And then of late, there's a new identity which has emerged, which is the queer identity, which is great, wonderful. And that's, it's very East London. So the East London techno scene is all like ironic tashes. It's like mullets. It's all that kind of stuff.
If only we had an example.
If only you had an example. So Tim is my long suffering husband. He just laughs at me all the time, because on Sundays we'll go for walks on Brick Lane, and then I'll bump into people that I've been to a rave with, and he says the conversations are always the same, which is, hi babe, and then they'll say, hi babe,
hi babe,
how you doing babe, oh my God, did you go to whatever night, yeah, so good babe, so good babe, all right babe, take care babe, bye babe. It's the same thing over and over again. But the reason I bring it up is because I think I understand that people like form those identities quite often. And you get this with any, I think, my opinion, you get it with any group that has experienced a kind of difficult time. So I'm Muslim. I think in terms of the British Muslim community, you get people like holding on to identities, you know, for life, right? You know, like, this is what I'm going to hold on to. Similarly, queer people, gay people, lesbians, trans people, whatever it might be. But quite often I find, and the East London queer scene is a good example of this, you can end up, in the hope to be inclusive, you can end up excluding people. And that's happened in the East London queer scene. Because, for example, like, I'll take friends. I love techno, right? I really like dancing. I'll take friends to those raves now. And people will literally come up to them and they'll be like, oh, you just look gay. You don't look queer.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? So what that means is, like, you look like a muscle gay. Like, you're wearing a leather harness and you just look like you go to standard gay clubs. You're not queer enough. You're not edgy enough. That's what they're saying.
They're queer fundamentalists.
Yeah. Like, what are we doing? Why would you want to, like, you know, escape one identity by, like, imposing your identity on a third party?
Go on, what's happening there? So unpick it for us.
So this is just my opinion. I think when you get any particular group that has experienced oppression, they just cling on to stuff. And I understand, it's like, I think it's part of human nature, but people do cling on to particular identities, and I don't think it's healthy. So, for example, we live at a particular time, I'm just going to put it out there, where I think there's, like, demonization of the Muslim community, hugely. I think when we talk about people coming in small boats, quite often it's shorthand for, like, they're those brown-skinned people and they're coming to take our women and all this, like, stuff, right? And so because we're in that climate, I know people, and when I was a teenager, I went through, like, a few years of, like, predominantly being defined as a Muslim. That was the first, like, I was very, very visibly Muslim. And, you know, that's great, it's fine. But I just think you need to, like, question your motivation. Like, why are you holding on to particular aspects of your identity? And that includes being gay or lesbian or trans. Like, it's an aspect of your identity. It's not every, like, people are complicated, right? People are, like, a full thing. They're a range of things. They're someone's son or daughter. They're, you know, someone's lover, perhaps. They're someone's friend. Your work is an aspect of that. What motivates you? All of human beings are complicated. So I don't think it's particularly healthy to fixate on one particular part of identities, whatever that might be, and project that to the world, because that isn't doing justice to the complexity of who we are.
I'm really interested in your...
Thank you.
I'm really interested in your inner resilience, or where you get the resources from to be able to say that and also do it. Because you're talking about it being human nature for people who are oppressed to maybe become a bit fundamentalist. But, like, you've experienced a lot of that, haven't you? Like, Muslim, brown, queer. And yet what you're saying is...
Sunshine and rainbows.
Sunshine, rainbows. Yeah. And you got a lot of grace. And you can even talk about those communities with a lot of grace. Like, where's all this coming from? Is this, do you think any of this was in your spiritual formation?
It's all an act. No, I'm kidding. So, God, that's really complicated. So some of it definitely was in my spiritual formation, to use that phrase. I think so I see, like, Islam or any religion as a lens with which you see the world. I don't believe anymore that religious people have any kind of monopoly on morality. I just don't believe that.
Get out.
Right? And so, wild, right? So I don't believe that anymore. And I used to when I was a teenager, I think, for a little period. But I don't believe that. I think I'm, like, quite grounded in terms of having a family that is very humbling, in the sense that my parents barely speak English, which means they watch everything that I do and have no clue what it's about. I did, for example, a documentary a couple of years ago. It was about a scandal in Japan. It was really grim. It was about a public figure who was a very prolific paedophile. And it was a massive scandal. And when the program went out, I was so proud of it. It was one of my proudest moments. As a result of the program, it was mentioned in the Japanese parliament. I got the Freedom of the Press Award in Japan. They changed the law in Japan on defining rape. Before the documentary went out, there was no statutory acknowledgement that a man could be raped. It didn't exist. So they changed the law as a result of the program. It was one of my proudest moments. And I remember my parents did what they always do, which is, like, I speak to them just after the program's gone out on linear TV, because they've watched it. And I told them that this was going to be quite difficult to watch. Anyway, so I call up, but like it finishes at 9 p.m. No, it finished at, it was on at 9 on BBC Two, finished at 10. Call up at 5 past 10. And my mom, like the first, she speaks Punjabi, so I'll just give you the English translation. She's like, yeah, the roads are so busy in Japan, aren't they? What? That was the first thing she said, because like they don't necessarily like see the world in the same way. The reason I reference that is that I think my family can be quite humble, and then I've also got a very lovely husband who like I can talk to about that stuff, and I talk to about kind of, I think I can get quite bleak. Like a lot of the subject matter that I deal with is very, very bleak, and I gravitate towards that stuff. And I really love my job, but I've seen some horrible things and met some really, really horrible people, like target killers in Mexico, or like convicted terrorists and cells in Pakistan, or people on death row in America. And so some of that stuff can be really, really bleak. But I think I talk about everything, and I see a therapist.
Yeah. Bit of therapy in there too. So you mentioned him, and you told me earlier that it's your anniversary a couple of days ago.
It was. It was our ninth wedding anniversary, and 20 years since we met. It'll be 21 years in December since we met.
You were babies.
Yeah.
When was that? Were you at uni?
No, we were 24, 25, 26. Yeah, so we're 46. Okay. Yeah. Whatever. He's only 3 months younger than me. Shut up.
How did you meet?
So we met in a club called Ghetto. I can't say the name of the night there because it's rude.
Oh, but I think we're okay with that, aren't we?
So the night, it was called The Cock, wasn't it? Yeah, it's called Cock. It's like a, so Ghetto is a club. If anyone knows it, it's, or it doesn't exist anymore, but it was just off Soho Square. So it was when a lot of the clubs were in what you'd call like the West End. Like they've all moved from there now. I lived in Manchester. Scandalous story. So I'd met a boy on, this is in the days of gaydar, which was like dial-up connection. Hello, how are you? And then you chat to someone. So I've been speaking to this person. I wasn't like properly out or anything at the time. I'd been speaking to this guy for ages, and he said, come to London. We're going to go out. And the plan was, like, he was my romantic interest, let's put it that way. And he was going to take me out in London for the first time because I wasn't on the scene or anything. I was very young and naive. And so I came all the way to London to stay with this boy. And then we met at a bar, and then he took me to this club. He was my love interest, supposedly so. We'd been speaking for like 3 months. But that night I saw Tim. And you know what the first thing I said to Tim is? So we went up, because Tim's so dainty, obviously the first thing we did is kiss, right before we spoke. And then we kissed. And then the first thing I said to him is, we could get married. That was the first thing I said to him. And 10 years after that, I proposed. 10 years to the night, I proposed.
I didn't think a story in a club called Cock was going to be so romantic. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So is Tim your like first and only long-term relationship?
I had a couple before that, but they were like very short. Yeah. So he's like the real deal. He's the real deal.
You're the real deal, Tim.
Yeah.
That was, I hope so. We are married.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's been if you've spent like so long in all these really dark places to have someone so consistently. I see that with friends who got together young in their early 20s, and I envy it a bit, because just to have that one person who you can do so much growing up with and have that first experience of the world not being the beautiful place you thought it was with someone else, it always strikes me as such a lovely thing.
I think it is, and what it's given me, this is turning into a therapy session in itself, what it's given me is wherever in the world I am, and whatever kind of bleakness I'm dealing with. And even this week, I was having a breakdown at work with something that I'm working on at the moment. I was having a really difficult time with it. I always gravitate towards the couch at home and drinking tea. So my favorite thing is being at home and drinking tea with Tim there. Sometimes whilst watching Judge Judy. I don't know why I love that show so much. It's so ridiculous. Not very highbrow, sorry. But yeah, so I always have that to kind of come back to. And so I feel kind of rooted. I think that is the word. I feel rooted and grounded by that.
Mabeen, you're a complex person. You contain multitudes.
Cute.
Right. I think we should have some questions from the floor. I also think that we should talk about your mastermind topic. And so I wonder if we could combine them. And if the first question from the floor should be someone asking you a question about Prince to see if you can answer it.
Yeah, of course.
Can anyone hear? Okay, so Mabeen is actually 2026 Celebrity Mastermind Champion. Don't know if we mentioned that. Proudest award. You've done a documentary on Prince, haven't you?
Thank you.
You're like Prince is your...
I'm a super fan. I've been on stage with Prince, you know.
Have you? When?
So it was the Montreux Jazz Festival. He was performing three nights in 2014. So it's 2 years before he passed.
Gosh.
It's 2014. He's performing three nights. There's me and three friends. We're going from London, flying to Montreux. It's going to be really easy. We're going to get there in loads of time for the first show. What happens? We get to the airport. All flights to... I think you need to go via Geneva, don't you? So all flights to Geneva are cancelled. So we're like, okay, fine. We're going to get on a train. We're going to do the Eurostar. Then we're going to go to Montreux. So the first night we get there and we get there at like midnight. We've missed the first show. This makes me sound like a stalker, but I ended up just by chance. Montreux is a small place. So the best hotel is called the Montreux Palace. So I'm staying at the Montreux Palace. Guess who's staying at the Montreux Palace? Prince and the band. I see Prince and the band. Well, I see the band at breakfast, not Prince. He doesn't come out of his room. The band, I get talking to them. Ha, ha, I'm going to be at the show tonight. Ha, 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 ha. And they're all lovely. So by the third night, they know this guy. They like me. They know me. Does anyone know who Larry Graham is? Larry Graham was the bass player for Sly and the Family Stone many years ago. Okay. He's also, I think he's of the like Jehovah's Witness faith. And Prince kind of counted him as an older brother. Larry Graham was there. So I was talking to him. He was lovely. Spoke about Jesus with Larry Graham, actually. Wow. It's very, very nice. And so, yeah, so they kind of vaguely recognize me. And for some reason, because I'm so shy, of course, I painted a big purple heart on the side of my head for the third night. And I was right at the front. And so because they've seen me at breakfast for a couple of days, during the encore, one of the band members is a dancer, actually. She came over and she just stuck her hand out. And my friends were like, go, go, go. And they all just lifted me up and plonked me on the stage. And Prince was doing, he was doing the intro to When Doves Cry. And so I was like, in my head, I thought, like, this is the one chance. So I've got to look good. I've got to dance. And I know the persona of Prince. And he, from what I know, he doesn't like people kind of being like, oh my God, I love you. He doesn't like that. So I danced and walked over and very calmly just said, I love you. And then he was on his keyboard and he nodded and did this. And then I stayed on stage for like 25 minutes. They left me up there. It was great. I had the time of my life. It was beautiful.
That sounds like top. Where would you rank that in top moments of your life?
Oh my God. I mean, it's like definitely like top 15 somewhere. Whoa,
you've had a great life.
I've had a really good
25
life.
25 minutes on stage.
I've had a really great
maybe
life.
Maybe 14.
It's up there. It's great.
Yeah. Right, audience, you've had enough time now. Has anyone got a niche Prince question they want to ask Mabeen? The people at the front are like, obviously not. Come on, somebody. I don't know enough about Prince to ask any niche Prince questions. All right, well, we'll leave that. Nice idea. Do you want to take questions from the audience or do you want to spin the big wheel?
If we've got questions...
Spin the wheel.
Spin the wheel. Oh, God, you decided for me.
Does everyone know how this works? Does anyone know how this works? Yes and no. Okay, so we're going to spin the wheel.
Yep.
And it's going to fill this blank. Read us the card, Mabeen.
What does God have to do with blank?
And this is going to fill the blank. Are your eyes better than mine? Because there is no way.
This is testing my eyes. I can read the big text, not the little text. Hold up, where's the arrow pointy thing? Is it?
Cameron says...
Making the world a better... So the question is, what does God have to do with making the world a better place?
We can re-spin if this feels a bit
That's good. It's quite existential.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the Hope and Anchor.
Are we okay with existential? What does God have to do with making the world a better place? So I think... There's two answers to that question. I think God has everything to do with making the world a better place because for the majority of the world still, God is the center. It's like that, the anchor. And for people that believe in like ideas of an afterlife. There's this idea that what you put out is ultimately, like, it's going to be judged, right? My mom would love this, by the way. This is the bit where she'd be, like, cheering me on. So if there's an ultimate destination and there's an afterlife and whatever that looks like, then you need to be nice to people and you need to make the world better. And if there isn't, and this is the second part of my answer, God has nothing to do with it. Because as I said earlier, I don't think religious people have a monopoly on morality. And therefore, if God isn't at the center of your life, I think you're still very qualified. And some of the best people that I know, some of the most moral people that I know, and some of the people that spend their waking hours trying to make the world a better place are people that don't have God in their lives. And that's completely fine too.
And tell us where you're at with God.
Are you really, really? Have we got, yes, okay.
You all want to know, don't you?
I'm just going to be completely honest. I'm in quite a difficult place with that stuff at the moment. I think when I was about 14, 15, 16, I was super Muslim. So I'm talking about praying 5 times a day. I'd go to mosque early to hoover the carpet. I was like so super Muslim. And then I did theology as a master's. It's like really interested in that. And then I think the older I've got, I've kind of, and maybe other people go through, I'm sure lots of people go through this, I kind of got disillusioned with organized religion. I find like the org, so it's the equivalent of, I know we'd call the church as in the establishment of the church, so the equivalent would be the mosque, but I'm talking about the function of religion, the hierarchy of religion, the establishment of religion. I find that stuff really difficult. And I think all reasonable people, wherever you are with that stuff, will take issue with how historically all organized religion in some capacity has been used to oppress people. Of course it has. Of course, every single religion, including Buddhism even, right? And so I take massive issue with that. And I think what I'm trying to do, this is where Tim comes back. Tim the other day, like just in passing, said to me, he's like, oh, I think that having religion like can give you a grounding. Maybe you just need to think about that stuff. And we have those conversations all the time. And I think in some ways, maybe I was happier when I was like, ultimate belief. I know this. I know there's a heaven. I know there's a hell. Because there was that certainty. I'm not in that place right now. I don't know if there's a heaven. I don't know if there's a hell. I'd like to believe there is. I'd like to believe there's an afterlife. I believe in nature. I definitely believe in nature. I believe in karma. That's not a very easy answer, is it? I'm really sorry. I'm just being honest, though. That's kind of where I am at the moment.
No, it's the honest answer and I appreciate it. And I think, I don't know how much you know about Greenbelt, but I imagine there are lots of people in the audience who that resonates with. I know it does with me. Every time there's a death in my family, I'm a Methodist. This is a Methodist venue. And my parents are probably more evangelical than I am. You know, maybe there's a similarity there with your parents. Mm-hmm. That definitely hold more closely to like doctrinal belief. Whenever there's a death, I feel so sad at the really certain faith that I've lost, because I know that they're like, grief is not, they feel grief differently because they are so certain of an afterlife. They are so certain of heaven. And I look at it with envy. And I'm glad that I've been on a journey that's been able to deconstruct some of the stuff that wasn't healthy. Mm-hmm. But I mourn some of the certainty that I think you're describing.
I'm in exactly that place. And my parents are, you know, I'm the youngest of 4 children. So my parents are in their 80s now. They're both like 82, 81, right? And so they're in a place where the older they've got, the more certain they've become. And I'm in exactly the same place. I really envy sometimes the way that it is such solid ground for them. Because when they talk about the next phase, they have absolute certainty that they're going to be together. They have absolute certainty that, you know, they might die in 5 or 10 years. They have absolute certainty they're going to see me again. And I would love to have that sometimes. But, and maybe I'll get there again. I don't know. Maybe I won't. I don't know. But that's where I am right now.
Life is long, isn't it? And what you describe sounds like difficult at the minute. But when you describe it, I hear growth. And maybe that'll be a gift, I hope so.
I hope so. I think I think, you know, I'm just going to say this. I know this is quite heavy, but I think the last few years, and whenever I've got a public platform, I'm very, very grateful for it. I always try to bring this into the conversation because it's on my mind all the time. I think the last 3 years, what we've seen in terms of Palestine has like broken my heart, like in the most fundamental way. And I think everyone will have a moment in their lives, perhaps or multiple moments in their lives, where they think, okay, like, where is God? Like, how can this be allowed to happen? Where is God in this? And I think, as well as kind of in my 20s, maybe, and in my 30s, kind of getting increasingly existential about organized religion and thinking, okay, I just need like spirituality. I don't need the organization anymore. I think in the last 3 years, my heart got broken. And I think for that reason, I'm trying to grab hold of something. I'm trying to grab hold of something. Like, I want justice. That's what I want. And that's in terms of like a free Palestine, but it's also in terms of like, there's like a lot of monsters around us at the moment. Do you know what I mean? Like, Donald Trump is a monster. Nigel Farage is a monster. Like, these people are like disgusting. In my view, they're not good people. And so, like, there's a lot of horrible stuff going on at the moment. And so I want to find God or whatever you call it in that.
And some of the stuff you've described.
Does anyone know where he is? Can you find him for me, please? Is he under that table? Yeah.
And some of the stuff you've described, like cups of tea on the sofa with your husband, or techno, or finding your people, they sound like they could be spiritual practices.
Oh,
actually,
my God.
They
could be searching
for some of that.
Yeah, yeah. In the best of it. So, you know, I was talking about tea. One thing that we started doing... If there's anyone here that is like wanting to reconnect or connect with their other half, if you can use that term, in a slightly different way, one thing that I would recommend is breakfast and Mariah Carey. We went on holiday. We went to Cambodia, beautiful place, in February. And we got into this rhythm of like just waking up earlier. We've stuck to waking up earlier pretty much the whole year, which means every morning before work, we drink tea and listen to the same Mariah Carey album. I don't know why it's the same Mariah Carey album, but we do. And it's such a special time. It's like just a beautiful thing in the morning. It's like when it works, it's just like a little drop of stardust for the day. It's just, I just love it so much. Go and listen to Mariah Carey and drink some tea.
Retinol, vitamin C, pay your television license, Mariah Carey and breakfast.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm conscious we've already got a couple of minutes left and I've kept talking about audience questions and I haven't taken any. I'm so sorry. If anyone would like to ask a question, now is your moment. We don't have a roving mic. We do have these microphones. So come up. Join the conversation and ask a question. Would anyone like to ask anything about anything we've spoken about? Any documentaries you've seen? Have we got any aspiring journalists who'd like to ask anything?
Is everyone shy?
Everyone shy?
Oh.
Cameron.
Yes, Cameron.
I imagine you've got to sit in a lot of like commissioning meetings and things for some of your films. I wonder if there's ever been a film you've wanted to make that you haven't been allowed to make and why that was.
Oh,
and if not,
yeah.
What would you love to make that
not
you haven't yet?
All the time. So the bane of my life is trying to persuade commissioners to like fund my projects. So I work to commission. So I made a documentary about Prince, but I want to make another one because Prince had what was... So I made a thing called Hunting for Prince's Vault. The findings of Hunting Prince's Vault, I went to Minneapolis, I went to his studio whilst he was still alive. So at the time, it was 2014, we concluded that if Prince was to leave the world in 2014, he had enough unreleased music to put out an album every year for 100 years. And that was like semi-scientific. I interviewed like people that he'd worked with since the 70s, all that. I want to do the follow-up to that, but there's this thing in the way, which is called the Prince Estate. Really annoying, so I want them to be my friends, and then I'll make that documentary. And then the other thing, So that was kind of like the light side of it, the very dark, grim side of it. As you will all know, journalists are not allowed into Gaza and haven't been for the last 3 years. I want to be one of those journalists. I think we need to know. I mean, the horrors of what have happened, I think we do know in many ways, but it needs to be documented. We use the phrase, don't we? We say, rightly so, we say never again. Never again has to mean for every single person in the world. And so I think that film needs to be made.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions? Because if not, I do have one that I threatened I was going to ask you.
Threatened.
Okay, in that case. One here. Do you want to come up or do you want to shout and we'll repeat into the mic? He's going to come up. Thank you.
Hiya. We met earlier.
Hello.
Hiya. Just what you're saying, all the bleakness of the stuff you covered in your documentaries, and I confess I haven't seen any, so we'll follow them up. What hope do you have for the world in the face of the brutality, the discrimination, the negative stuff that we see in the world? If you just take that purely, then we're sunk.
Yeah.
So what is the hope, or what do you see as the hope that can create the springboard, if you like, for people to think, act,
yeah,
differently?
What's your name?
I'm Pete.
Thank you, Pete. So, Pete, this answer is, I think I need to hear this as well as other people. I probably need to hear it more than other people because I'm a bit sad sometimes. So I think the hope that I have is the arc of history tells us that the general movement is in the direction of progress. It's in the direction of people being uplifted. It's in the general arc of history is in the direction of people gaining rights, and the civil rights movement and minorities gaining rights and people that are demonized no longer being demonized eventually. That's the direction of traffic, right? Generally. And it never goes like this. It kind of goes like this. But generally, it goes in the right direction. So the arc of history tells us that we're going to progress and things are going to be good. That's the hope I hold on to, but it comes with a caveat, and that caveat is we need to fight for it. Like, we need to collectively fight for it, and we need to take care of each other, and we can't be passive. And that means, you know, if your neighbors have questionable views or are doing horrible things, then have a conversation with them. It means if we've got family members who at Christmas will say things about particular minorities that you know not to be true, then, you know, be nice, but have that conversation with them. I think every single one of us has a part to play. That's what's going to change things, and that's what I want to happen.
I think we're going to end on that note. Mabeen, you are so charming. I have no doubt you're going to charm Prince's estate. You charmed his band. But also, you're a really good journalist. I didn't know that fact that you told us before about your documentary about Japan changing the law. That's incredible. And lots of people could live many lives and never be able to say something like that. So I take hope that there are people like you fighting the good fight. And I think little Mabeen will be proud too.
So kind of you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mabeen Azhar.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.